A, and that is Jose Garcia Lara versus Holder, and it's Mr. Cola.
Correct. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. With regard to this matter, Jose Garcia is being deported from the United States based on the allegation that he committed an aggravated felony. The aggravated felony normally strips this court of jurisdiction to even hear this case. The belief is that he was not convicted of an aggravated felony and that the proof that was presented at the lower level, at the immigration judge's level, does not warrant a finding that he was convicted of an aggravated felony. The aggravated felony in this case was criminal sexual abuse. It was not criminal sexual abuse of a minor. That was not alleged. He never pled guilty to that charge. He pled guilty to the criminal sexual abuse charge. Under Illinois law, there's several ways to charge criminal sexual abuse, and one is to a minor, and the other one is where you are abusing someone who is not capable of giving knowing consent, and that was what he was convicted of in this case.
Now, here's our problem, and it's a big problem.
Correct.
Neither of the arguments that you have made here regarding the classification of Mr. Garcia Lara's prior conviction was made to the BIA. So given the failure to exhaust, what authority do we have to reach the merits of these arguments?
You know, we would make the argument that on several grounds. First of all, the BIA has the inherent authority to look at the complete record. In this case, we have the immigration judge did a contested hearing on removability where the respondent, the petitioner in this case, denied the allegations of removability. So there was a hearing there, and that was a subject where the immigration judge issued his opinion that later went to the BIA on appeal. I would
agree. But specifically before the IJ, was this whole issue of the crime involving moral turpitude, that wasn't raised there before the IJ.
Before the IJ was whether or not he was convicted of an aggravated felony and with the admission of certain records.
So the problem with your position is that it would really weaken to the point of elimination the exhaustion requirement, because the point of the exhaustion requirement is to make sure that people have alerted the BIA to the particular arguments that they're trying to make, give the board a chance to address them. The board often has, the board does address these kinds of problems from time to time when they're raised. And so it's more than just saying to the board, well, here's the record, and if you were really paying a lot of attention, you read through it, you'd realize that these problems are here. That's just not the way we run the system. The Supreme Court has said an exhaustion requirement, and I'm thinking actually in the habeas context, but it's similar. You've got to actually say out loud what the problem is.
Correct, but I would agree with you. At a certain level, at the BIA level, something must be said. Otherwise, we can't hope them.
What was said here to alert the court to your arguments?
From the petitioner's point of view, Your Honor, nothing. From the issue that it was addressed by the BIA, it was clearly brought forward from the government's brief to the BIA where they talked about the categorical approach to determining if something is an aggravated felony or not.
There's all of that, but there are arguments about whether it was a misdemeanor and whether it was a felony and when was the statute amended and all sorts of things about that. They're a very complex area, actually, on the aggravated felony question and what's a crime of violence and the rest. The Supreme Court has been issuing decisions right and left about that. So it's just troubling that this isn't something that really seems to have been presented in an adversary way.
Would I have preferred it to have come out much better at the lower level? Most definitely. I'm not going to sit here and say that it was properly presented.
But well, then wouldn't the proper step be for Mr. Garcia Lara to file a motion to reopen with the BIA and to argue that his prior counsel was ineffective?
Yeah, the problems with
the board should take up the arguments that you're now making here for the very first time.
Correct. The problem with the motions to reopen and stuff, there's jurisdictional bars to doing a motion to reopen. And generally, I was not the counsel at the lower proceedings before the BIA or the IJ. I was strictly on this petition for review. Once we get the record, we're beyond the window of filing any motions to reopen with regard to that issue. But again, I would go back to the issue that the errors committed in this particular proceeding are so grave.
Are you saying that the time has run? Is that what you're saying?
For motions to reopen or motions to consider, it's 30 days or 90 days, depending on the time frame that we have. I'm assuming.
I thought the board had discretion to, for good cause, mm-hmm. to extend that.
for good cause for information that was not available at the time of the proceeding. At this particular case, this information, it's more of a legal argument than anything else. We're not introducing new evidence. We're not saying that, you know, in fact, he was not convicted of this. It's the evidence as it was. There's nothing new being added to the record. It's just another argument should have been made and was not properly made at the lower level.
The ineffectiveness of counsel, of course, the Attorney General has been in the process of revisiting the actions of the prior Attorney General on the way ineffectiveness is handled.
Correct.
That would be a reason to go back to issues that might have been raised before.
Sure. In June, the Attorney General vacated, the prior Attorney General's opinion and stated that aliens do have a right to effective assistance. So
I agree with you. However,
we're not here to tell you how to run your case.
I fully understand that, and I fully
this is a terrible business mm-hmm. here. It's a very, very upsetting case. Mm-hmm.
And I agree with you, and that's why we're saying and we're arguing that in this case, looking at the specific facts of this specific case, where the errors were committed the way they were, and that the board did discuss this issue briefly in their decision and the government in their response brief, not at the BIA level, did mention this issue, that we feel it was incumbent upon the board to look at this issue more closely.
Look, there's a lot we can do in a lot of cases, and there's a lot we can't do in a lot of cases. And I, for one, don't know what we can do about this error.
Mm-hmm.
And the IJ erred. Mm-hmm. But so did prior counsel.
Mm-hmm. I wish it would have been presented much more better, but I was given the record that I was given, and my position would rest on the fact that the board did briefly address this issue in a roundabout way. The government, the DHS, did address this in their respondent's brief, their reply brief. So we think that the board had an opportunity to correct this error. And this court has ruled in the past where the Board of Immigration's sua sponte can look into something and say you must address this. Like in the case of Asani, where the immigration judge did not present this a form of relief to the respondent. The attorney never addressed it either. It went up. Eventually, this court said you could. The board was under an obligation sua sponte to present the forms of relief available to a respondent, and we're saying that same philosophy should hold true in this case.
But even when you look at the record before the IJ, you know, these documents were just admitted without any objection. No objection was made. So even to tease it up, even though there was some small reference to it with the BIA, it's not even teased up specifically for the BIA because there was no objection to those documents.
Correct. I think from what prior counsel was not objecting to was that these are not correct documents. They are valid issued documents. They are
right.
Correct and true in their form. But what we're arguing is that they shouldn't have been given.
Oh, I understand what you're arguing.
Right.
Yeah. You're making the right argument.
I appreciate that.
At the wrong
time. At the wrong time, yeah.
In the wrong place. I think that's a song. Mm-hmm. All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Wendell, I can finally say good afternoon, Ms. Wendell.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Anne Mai Wendell. I represent the United States Attorney General. Petitioner faces two hurdles in challenging his removability as an aggravated felon based on his criminal sexual abuse involving a minor conviction.
But tell me this. Would the government oppose a motion to reopen before the BIA, given the obvious errors that the IJ made here and the apparent negligence of Mr. Garcia Lara's former counsel and failing to bring these errors before the attention of the board?
Your Honor, I'm not in a position to make that determination because that is a decision made by DHS. However, I would be inclined to indicate that the government would not agree to such a motion because we believe that the arguments raised regarding his removability as an aggravated felon, notwithstanding that they're belated, lack merit. And we've articulated in the brief those reasons. And we think that it's also consistent with this court's case law in terms of Lara Ruiz and other cases that have applied the sexual abuse of a minor definition of aggravated felony.
But he was, at the time he was convicted, the criminal sexual abuse was a misdemeanor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was not something punishable for long enough to count under the immigration statutes as a felony, period, notwithstanding all these other issues about, you know, intentionality and about risk of harm and all the rest of the things that the Supreme Court's been struggling with. And so it's just a blatant error. The judge is looking at the way a statute reads 10 years later and saying, oh, well, now that it's a felony, you must have been convicted of it, when in fact it wasn't. It'd be as though you were convicted of speeding, you know, and going 80 miles an hour at a time that it's a misdemeanor, and then 10 years later the state decides, well, we really have to crack down on speeders. It's now a minor felony. And you don't become a felon at that point. You were convicted of a misdemeanor, as was Mr. Garcia Lara.
Your Honor, there's two responses. First of all, to the extent that it's a serious issue that should have been considered, it should have also been raised. At no time did petitioner raise it.
But it wasn't raised because of the negligence of his attorney.
Right.
And I wanted to dig into the underlying issue. This is a serious point. This is not a frivolous point that somebody, you know, we see plenty of arguments that people make in these cases, but this is a very serious point about the proper characterization of the underlying earlier offense.
Your Honor, notwithstanding, this court's case law in Gautam and Guerrero-Perez have established that it doesn't matter if it was a misdemeanor. The fact that sexual abuse of a minor here, where the conviction documents clearly establish that the criminal sexual abuse did involve a minor, would still be a aggravated felony, notwithstanding the misdemeanor label.
I'm not sure. There's been a lot of law in this area, and I'm not at all certain, after cases like Nihajewan, like other cases, that one can say that. And the Supreme Court has been increasingly serious, let's say, about the categorical approach that needs to be taken, what can be considered on the conviction documents and what shouldn't be considered on the conviction documents. Whether you know it or not, you're wading into a very complex area.
Mm-hmm. Your Honor, I respect the court's concerns, but nonetheless, the hurdle here that petitioner cannot overcome is the fact that he failed to exhaust these claims.
Correct.
And to the extent that he wishes, and should he wish to pursue it further, then the appropriate form is not before this court. It would be before.
That's why we're asking you if I asked you if you would oppose a motion to reopen so that justice might be done.
Mm-hmm.
Justice might be what the government believes it to be.
And
on the other hand, justice might not be that.
Your Honor, I agree, but again, that is something that is incumbent upon petitioner to then also raise with DHS, because it is not an appropriate forum, also because I cannot represent make that decision. In any event, here, as the court has pointed,
we know you can't, but I mean, if you didn't oppose the motion to reopen, and because this is an area that is very problematic, you know, perhaps good law could come out of it. We're not saying there has to be a concession. Anyway.
Oh, of course not. No,
we're not saying that.
Your Honor, and that's something that petitioner can raise with DHS. Here before the court is an issue that is constrained to the record, and the record does limit the review to simply this issue that is not subject to consideration by the court. Because of the failure to exhaust, the court, pursuant to its case law in Kursinski and Sharazi's, as well as other cases, should dismiss the claims that have been raised for the first time on review. As far as any other considerations are concerned, then petitioner can choose to speak with DHS and present it before the board.
Let me just pursue this a little further. But DHS does consult sometimes with the Justice Department.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes. And so the Justice Department can make recommendations about this.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. So I'm just, I mean, it's not just throw it over to DHS. It seems to me that the Justice Department can have some role in this in terms of a recommendation when it seems like a fundamental injustice was done.
Your Honor, and it also is, again, incumbent. The Justice Department will then come into play whether either because DHS brings it to the attention of the Justice Department or if petitioner actually
But you see, you are
it.
The Justice Department
right.
today.
Right.
Yes, Your Honor.
So you can carry this message back to the main Justice Department, can't you?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes.
And what I can also do, but again, what I'm saying is it's also incumbent upon petitioner presenting some basis for a reopening that allows for, in this case, it's based on a procedural administrative process that the Justice Department can only comment upon but cannot actually decide upon. And before this court, that is not something that can be taken into account.
But the issue really is that this court obviously has its jurisdictional limits with unexhausted claims, but it ill behooves the Justice Department to say that there is an illusory remedy out there that actually isn't a remedy, and that we're in the business of removing people from the country for the wrong reason, and that we're in the business of allowing errors to stand uncorrected, even though there might be a mechanism for correction available if the Justice Department would just let it unfold and see if it's meritorious. It may not be at the end. It may be at the end. But it's disturbing to think that there's this illusory promise of something that's not real.
And we've got to put aside, the reasons that a particular mm-hmm. defendant, or I shouldn't say defendant here, I should, say petitioner, is here before us, because there's a lot more at stake than this one particular petitioner.
Yes, Your Honor. And the government does take that into consideration, and the government also would urge petitioner's counsel to contemplate some of the issues that the court has raised, because some of the nuances, references to some of the Supreme Court decision, have not even been raised on review. Those are concerns that the court has put before the parties. This, again, is something, there's different means by which it can be legitimately considered by the board, by DHS, and have the Justice Department weigh in upon it. It hasn't been raised yet, and based on this record and the case before the court, I can only assure the court that those considerations are made if presented in the proper channels. Here it has not yet been done so, but as far
so the bottom line is you're not even going to go back and tell the Justice Department our concerns and that
I can assure Your Honor that I will express to the Justice Department in my office those concerns. I can do that. However, I cannot assure the court that anything will actually be acted upon.
We know that.
And in that regard, then I would point out again
the Justice Department.
That
all three of us
that this case is limited to the record, and as a result the court should dismiss the petition. However, I will raise before my office the concerns that the court has raised, and should petitioner's counsel deem it appropriate to file a motion to reopen or to pursue any other channels further, then counsel is welcome to speak with me regarding the case. However, as it is, the court should dismiss the petition.
Oh, you are a prosecutor. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Anything further? Is there anything more you want to say?
With regard to this issue, again, we would ask the court to look at what transpired in this case. Obviously, it would have been better if these arguments were put forward a long time ago, but they weren't. Our hands are a little bit tied at this point, so and we appreciate the court's efforts with dealing with counsel on the other side. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess until, believe it or not, sometime in the month of August.